Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The state holds the first in a series of forums next week, seeking to foster deeper discussion about black history in the first state.
It's amazing what people don't know, and if you have no reason to try to learn about it, you just keep on being ignorant.
Reba Hollingsworth from the Delaware Heritage Commission joins us to discuss the forums and teaching black history in Delaware. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about changes to one Wilmington-based charter school struggling to find its niche, and how a tracking tool designed to help the endangered Atlantic sturgeon is evolving. All of that and Arts Playlist are next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Next week, the state of Delaware joins the Delaware Heritage Commission to launch a series of forums on black history in the first state. The first of these virtual events is this Wednesday, June 16th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m., ahead of this year's celebration of Juneteenth. It will discuss Juneteenth as well as some other topics with Dr. Donna Patterson, chair of Delaware State University's Department of History, Political Science, and Philosophy, as well as Dr. Reba Hollingsworth and Syl Walford from the Heritage Commission. This week, we spoke with Dr. Hollingsworth about the forums and teaching black history. What can you tell us about these black history forums that are getting started next week with the one on Juneteenth? What's the goal, and what do you hope people can take away from them?
Well, I think that there's all of a sudden kind of a renaissance about the black community in the United States now, and people want to, or they act like they want to know something, and as soon as they find out something they didn't know, then all of a sudden they're surprised. I know that last year when we did the panel with the governor on Juneteenth, I don't know how much he had known about it before then, but it was that was the beginning of it. And then, of course, after the legislature decided that they wanted to include black history in the curriculum, then people really got interested in, you know, what is it about blacks that we don't really know? Well, I can tell you that there's an awful lot. But
I was going to say, I mean, you mentioned the fact that you had the forum last year around Juneteenth with Governor Carney, and then it was things that he was surprised to learn about. Does that still surprise you that even people like the governor of the state need kind of like a primer on black history in Delaware?
Well, it doesn't surprise me because of the system in education in the state of Delaware, and the fact that when you go back through the history anyway, that the English people, wherever they went, thought that everybody was stupid except them. And so they really didn't try to open their minds and their ears and eyes to the cultures of the countries where they were invading. And even with blacks, so a lot of people, blacks and whites alike, to think that the black people only got to this country as slaves without realizing that actually blacks were here way before Christopher Columbus ever called himself discovering America. But there's so much that people don't know, and because it was never taught as a part of the history of the United States, people are ignorant. And so none of us know. We don't know what we don't know a lot of times, and there's an awful lot that we really don't know, especially if we haven't tried to study it. And in my experience, white people for a long time only saw us as shadows, and, you know, we were supposed to be stupid. I've even been patted on my head and asked how I know so much, kind of thing. But it's amazing what people don't know, and if you have no reason to try to learn about it, you just keep on being ignorant.
This first forum is again going to focus in part because of the timing on Juneteenth itself, mm-hmm. and that's something that has been getting some increasing attention in recent years. Before we kind of delve into some of the other things you were talking about, what do you feel people should know about Juneteenth? What we hope they would learn during a forum like next week's about Juneteenth?
Well, the Juneteenth actually is a kind of a misnomer in the way, that a lot of people celebrate on several different ways, from the 13th through the 19th, because there were slaves in the state of Texas who did not get the message of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation until June, and so the various days, Juneteenth, and so when they got the message, then they started celebrating. I remember as a child that, you know, we used to celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation with watch night services, which is what blacks would do on the eve before January 1st of the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. But if, you know, again, you don't know something, you haven't gotten the information, then when you do, then, you know, that's when you're surprised. But there's so much about black history that has been swept under the carpet, hidden from people, even like the Tulsa, Oklahoma. Sorry, right. I know you know about that one, too. The Black Wall Street and all that. You know, for 100 years almost, it was just swept under the rug, and people ignored that it happened, and that's more than 400 people were killed and all those kind of things. So, again, Juneteenth is the same way. All of a sudden, people are now finding out that this is a day that blacks celebrated in Texas. I don't think it has the same, for me, importance, because you know, it happened in Texas and not in Delaware.
Right.
Delaware is a little bit different because actually Abraham Lincoln even came to Delaware to talk to some of the legislators before the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, and I don't know whether a lot of people even know that.
Right.
The lady who's going to be on the panel with us is from Texas, and she's going to be the one who actually is going to talk about Juneteenth as it relates to Texas. So,
and you had mentioned to me that you wanted to talk during the forum next week a little bit more about the Emancipation Proclamation itself. What are some of the things you're hoping to kind of, you know, connect with people on that about as part of this forum and kind of help them connect the dots between Juneteenth and the Emancipation Proclamation?
Well, one of the things is that Abraham Lincoln actually did not intend to free the slaves, and I think people need to know that. And he really wanted to save the Union. And it happened that in order to save the Union, there was all of this difference in the country, and he ended up having to make several changes in his initial Emancipation Proclamation in order to make it acceptable. And his intention actually was to send the slaves back to Africa or into South America and keep America as what they call the white country. That's one of the things. But I just want to try to inform people that we are celebrating something that certainly is important to us, but it didn't really do what many people think it did, that is to free the slaves. It really did not.
Yeah, I just talking to you now about these things and how you kind of, you know, you're able to kind of connect the dots between Juneteenth and the Emancipation Proclamation and kind of giving people, you know, information about all these things and what they really mean. Is the kind of this growing attention on Juneteenth and some of these other aspects of black history helping, do you think, engage people more about black history? I know you've said a couple of times, like, you only know what you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like these are real opportunities to really start this discussion and move this discussion forward in ways that it hasn't before?
I do, if people will receive it. If they will actually receive the fact that there is a lot that they don't know and could know, rather than saying that they don't want to know it and they don't want any of the negative history actually brought to the fore, which is why some of the people are still right now just complaining about teaching black history in the schools. But again, you know, history is history, and we have to look at it rather than trying to sanitize it. And so that's what I think has happened a lot of times, that, you know, we've tried to sanitize history, especially as it relates to blacks, because, you know, as I said earlier, a lot of people don't even realize that blacks were in the United States before Christopher Columbus and before a lot of white people were here. And the impact is here. You know, as a matter of fact, have a book that talks about the blacks in the United States, written by Ivan Van Sertinum, called They Came Before Columbus, the African-American Presence in the Ancient America. And so if people really start to learn, I think they will have a different attitude about blacks. At least that's the hope for most of us. But there are still some who want to close their ears, close their eyes, close their minds to anything that they think is going to somehow throw a negative light on them.
Is that also true of guess yourself personally? And I know you've discussed in the past a lot about your personal experiences with segregated schools in Delaware and pursuing your education. Mm-hmm. Is that also something that's important for people to hear? Is to hear these more personal stories like yours that maybe can make this a little bit more real, if they're willing, as you said, to hear them?
Yeah. I think it has over the time that I've been talking about, because that's been all my life, as a matter of fact, because when we were in the segregated schools, when I came along, the teachers actually included the contributions of blacks in each of the subjects. But you know, as I think about my own personal life, I have educated parents. My dad and mom were, wanting to make sure we got an education, and my dad used to tell us that we didn't have to bow down to anybody because we were as good as everybody else kind of thing. So my attitude was a little bit different. And they used to tell us, learn as much as you can, and the brain between the ears, the same color as everybody else, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So people have to open their minds, I think, and really want to know, and some of them really are. I've had, as a matter of fact, at our church we had a discussion on a couple of books this past winter and spring, and a lot of the people who participated were from the white churches as well, and their eyes were opened. And when you talk about some of the experiences that we had personally and otherwise, a lot of people are surprised that these things occurred, especially when it wasn't important enough for them in their lives to see that it made a difference in somebody else's.
And you mentioned earlier, the bill that's been passed by the General Assembly to improve teaching of black history in schools here in Delaware, requiring school districts to include more black history education in their curriculum. Clearly, this is a positive step, but I am wondering what you think that curriculum should look like, what it should emphasize. How important is it to have people like yourself help inform what this curriculum looks like to make sure that it actually produces the goal that it's set out to reach?
Well, I think it's important, and I think that there are a few of us still left who had personal experiences with the segregated education in the state of Delaware, and not all of us received a broader experience. First, as I said, my dad and mother were sticklers for education, kind of thing that How do I say this? Actually, they made sure that we learned what we could, and they made sure that we read. They taught us to read and write before we went to school, which is another stickler of mine. Mm-hmm. There was a law in the state of books, I think until 1973, that said blacks in the state of Delaware only needed enough education to read, write, and count a bit. And my response to that is, well, I needed to go to school because my parents had already taught me that before I went to school. that's my smart answer. but you see, again, it points to that point that I've been making all along, that you don't know what you don't know. And everybody knows something that somebody else does not know.
That lived experience, mm-hmm. is you really can't substitute it.
Right.
And I guess that the key for this kind of curriculum is understanding that you've got to try and pull as much of that lived experience as you can together to teach young people so that they have a foundation that they're not surprised when they're 30, 40, 50 years old to hear stories and things that you're talking about with us today.
Yeah, they need to really realize that there are, not only with black people, but with all cultures, like a lot of people, they talk about Africa as if it were a country, right, instead of a continent. Well, if you look at all the countries, I think there are 43 countries in Africa, each of them speaking a different language. And then you bring all these slaves over here calling them ignorant because they don't speak English. But nobody called the whites Englishmen, and the people who were stealing the slaves and bringing them over here, call them ignorant because they didn't know the various Swahili and all the various mm-hmm. languages that were spoken in the countries in Africa. So it's that kind of thing that people really, I think, need to know, that there's a broad world out here, and stop closing your mind to whatever it is. Open your mind to receive whatever there is to learn about everything. A lot of the inventions that people take for granted, for instance, were actually inventions made by black people. Not all of them got credit for it because the whites would steal their ideas and patent it for themselves, but there are lots of things that we blacks know that were invented by black people, but whites got credit for it. And of course, there were other things that more recently that blacks did get credit for it. The windshield wiper and stop mm-hmm. sign and all those kind of things, the cars that people drive and the sewing machine, a lot of things that we know as blacks, or some of us know. I don't even know, the younger ones don't know it because they've never been taught it.
Right.
But Yeah, there's an awful lot that we can learn, and you know, I hope I live long enough to help at least open the door so that it will be a part of the ongoing history.
Well, I want to finish on this because you mentioned keeping an open mind and people being willing and receptive to hear these things and learn these things. Mm-hmm. Do you worry that there was still a fair amount of resistance to the bill, you know, trying to get more Black education into curriculum? Do you mm-hmm. worry that resistance is still an indication that there's not enough receptiveness and what that might mean for actually trying to implement a bill like this?
I do worry about it because it's that kind of thing when Blacks start making progress, there's always somebody making a law or taking some kind of actions to dispel the progress of the Blacks. And that's in our history as well. If you go, you know, even as I mentioned, Tulsa and Florida, the Rosemont City and all the others that were destroyed by whites because Blacks were making too much progress. And you know, even in Delaware, there was a school that was built by Blacks down in Slaughter Neck. You know where Slaughter Neck is,
mm-hmm.
I know.
Yep.
And it was actually burned by the white man's party. And they said that Blacks didn't need any education, so there was no point for them to have a school. Well, that was right here in Delaware, mm-hmm. you know. And a lot of people, I don't think, even know that because like, they don't study their Delaware history. I don't know where it is in the Delaware history, except that I, you know, as a Black person, have studied both Black history and have had the experiences of traveling extensively and all those kind of things that have opened me up for receiving and not being closed-minded about the contributions of people worldwide.
Thanks to Dr. Reba Hollingsworth from the Delaware Heritage Commission for joining us on The Green this week. The Delaware Forum on Racial History and Juneteenth, hosted by the State of Delaware and the Delaware Heritage Commission, is Wednesday, June 16th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. It can be seen at de.gov/live and Governor John Carney's Facebook and YouTube pages. And stay with us, contributor Larry Nagengast joins us to discuss a charter school looking to shrink as it struggles to find its niche. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. 2 weeks ago, we looked at some charter schools expanding to meet demands they are seeing. This week, we look at one, Great Oaks, that's facing some issues and looking to shrink in coming years. Contributor Larry Nagengast has its story in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to discuss their situation. So first off, can you tell us a little bit about Great Oaks Charter School and its track record over its six-year history?
Yeah, sure. Gray Oaks came to Wilmington in 2015 as one of three charter schools that would find a home in the community education building just a couple of blocks from Rodney Square. It was part of a larger Great Oaks organization, which operated charter schools in New York, in New Jersey, and in Connecticut. And the instructional model for Great Oaks includes 2 hours a day of one-on-one tutoring in English and math, intended to bring academic performance of children from low-income families back up to grade level and beyond. Now, Great Oaks involved a little bit more than 200 sixth graders that year and planned to add a grade a year to become a combination middle school and high school. Now, things went pretty well for 3 years, and then other charter schools started adding middle school grades from their, in addition to their lower grade programs, and Christina School District consolidated its buildings into grades 1 through 8 programs. These are the buildings in the city, and that made it harder for Great Oaks to recruit and to retain middle school students. Now, this came all as Great Oaks was starting its high school program, but Great Oaks didn't really put good support systems in place for that high school operation. And then some of the school's original leaders left. They moved out of state or took other jobs, and there weren't enough strong people in place to take over. Not unusual for a small school where you don't have a whole lot of backup. Some teachers then left. The academics took a hit. The enrollment dropped. Management at the very top also became an issue because it was based in New York with the foundation headquarters, and that limited its ability to quickly solve problems as they developed in Wilmington. Now there's a new management team in place. The school's board of directors is based in Wilmington, and Great Oaks is kind of in a rebuilding mode.
And part of that rebuilding mode is to shrink its footprint, dropping the middle school grades to focus on high school. What prompted that request, and how would it work if it's approved?
Well, as I said, the school's enrollment declines prompted the request, and the fact that other public schools in the city, both traditional and charter, were moving to this K-8 or 1-8 configuration made it harder for Great Oaks to keep 6th grade as the desired point of entry here. So if Great Oaks is going to have a small enrollment, you know, 300 or so students, it believes it can do better by focusing its efforts on having 75 or 80 students at each of the 4 high school years than by spreading itself thin over 50 or so students in both middle school and high school grades. Now, if the charter modification is approved, here's how the change would work. Great Oaks would serve grades 7 through 12 in the coming year, 8 through 12 in 22-23, and then become high school only in the fall of 2023. No current student would be forced to leave, and new students will be admitted in 7th and 8th grade this fall and in 8th grade in the fall of 2022.
So the state's Charter School Accountability Committee recommends approving this plan, but with some conditions. Can you talk a little bit about those conditions?
Sure. But first, let me make clear. The conditions that were set out represent things that the school is willing to do and what it should be doing. So it's not as though anything that I've mentioned or I'm going to mention here is in any way punitive or onerous. And also Leland Kent, who's the executive director of the school, says Great Oaks is already on its way to meeting these conditions. First of all, the school has until the 1st of July to submit a plan showing it how it will have at least 65% of its teachers certified in their content areas by September 1st. Next, also by July 1st, the school has to submit a plan showing how it will recruit more students by September 1st. And then it will also have to submit monthly reports on recruitment and enrollment until the end of September. Then, by the end of October, it's got to submit a budget that shows that the school is financially viable based on whatever the September 30th enrollment count is. Finally, by next April 1st, enrollment must be at least 260 students, which would be 80% of the school's authorized enrollment of 325. And if the enrollment falls between 80 and 90% of that authorized level, the school must also submit another revised budget showing that it will have financial viability based on the actual enrollment numbers that it has next spring.
Now, we've seen other charters get this type of conditional approval and wind up with kind of mixed results. Can Great Oaks meet these conditions? You mentioned that they're on their way to some of them. How does the outlook for them meeting these conditions look?
Well, you know, the way the conditions are structured, there's no convenient way for the state to take action against the school if the conditions aren't met, at least not until we get to where the April enrollment numbers come in. But, you know, there have been some mid-year closures of charter schools in the past, so you can't rule that out entirely. However, there is a process that has to be followed. It's something that's called the formal review, and that can take a couple of months to play out anyhow. So, my best guess here is that if Great Oaks is satisfied with its enrollment numbers at the start of the fall semester, it will find a way to get through the year. But it's going to be in a tough position next spring if enrollments are down and all of the other conditions are not met.
Some of the issues we're seeing with Great Oaks that you've mentioned are similar to ones other struggling charters have faced in the past, things with enrollment, with management. What happened here in those areas, similar or different to what we've seen before?
Well, yeah, we've seen variations on this theme before, certainly. I mean, even as charters grow by adding one grade a year, their leaders don't always have the needed management structures in place operate with larger number of grade levels, and especially when you're jumping from middle school and into high school or from elementary into middle, that sort of thing, it becomes a little bit more complicated. Sometimes also the founding leaders of a school may have great vision, but they may be short on the nuts and bolts of management skills that become more important as a school establishes itself. You know, and that was part of the problem at Great Oaks. A great vision, but not quite as strong on the nuts and bolts of management. Now, on top of that, as I indicated, the school was part of an organization directed by a foundation based in New York. So, yes, that foundation did have experience starting other charter schools and doing it well. But when there were problems in Wilmington that couldn't be resolved in a phone call, that 125-mile distance between Manhattan and Rodney Square really became a road too far for them to handle easily.
And the timing of these issues with the pandemic didn't help either, did it?
Correct. The pandemic upended everything. And in Great Oaks' case, the new management team was settling in just as the pandemic hit. And that meant that it had to navigate this transition to remote learning and later to the hybrid mode that all the other schools were experiencing, when they really would have preferred to be spending their time stabilizing their regular operations and starting to build fresh bridges into the Wilmington community.
So what are some of the other things Great Oaks is trying to do to help stabilize its current situation?
Well, one thing worth mentioning very pragmatically is that when it eliminates the middle school grades, the school will only need to use one floor, not two, in the community education building. So that means it's going to save on rent. More importantly, the school has begun building these bridges into the community that I just mentioned. Now, during the just-finished school year, Great Oaks established relationships with two groups that operate learning pods. These are settings where 8 or 10 students can gather during the day, log into their lessons online, and have the benefit of adult supervision and assistance rather than being home with no one to care for them in these remote learning situations. Another partnership is with an organization that provides summer, after-school, and weekend programming. And also arrangements are in the works to partner with The Warehouse, that teen service center that we've talked about in the past that opened last year as part of the Reach Riverside redevelopment initiative. Also, Great Oaks is planning to offer a summer learning program that will be open to students from other schools as well as to the Great Oaks students themselves.
So often we've seen charters that face distress have difficulty climbing out of the hole that they're in. The issues get out there to see, makes it hard to recruit and retain students, and there's kind of this spiral, this vicious circle. Can Great Oaks overcome that? Is this a test case to see if the state can really resuscitate a struggling charter school?
Now, I don't know that you would call it a test case for the state because, quite frankly, the burden is on the school, although, you know, certainly the folks at the State Department of Education are going to try to be supportive to the extent that they can. But first of all, it would be very disappointing for the advocates of charter schools to see Great Oaks fail. First of all, Great Oaks had arrived in Wilmington with great aspirations because of the success of Great Oaks programs in other cities, and it rented space in that plush community education building, that former MBNA office site that has been repurposed to become a hub for multiple charter schools. So I think Great Oaks will have a lot of people working hard to help it establish itself as a high school. However, it will have to do better at recruiting students as they leave schools that end their instruction at the eighth grade, charters like Eastside and Edison, Kumba and First State Montessori, and those traditional public schools, Bancroft and Byard, in the Wilmington portion of the Christina School District. Now, it's possible that Great Oaks will rebuild and prosper, but as we've seen with the charter school movement in Delaware, only the strong survive. And if Great Oaks can't strengthen its survival instinct, it will be time for its directors to turn in the school's charter or risk having the state take it away.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week. His piece on Great Oaks Charter School is available at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with the latest edition of Arts Playlist. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A service dog training program in Maine State Prison is the setting for a new book by author and former Marine Craig Grossi. Grossi's second book is called Second Chances, A Marine, His Dog, and Finding Redemption. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Grossi returns to chat with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about his latest work.
I want to bring the listeners up to speed. You and I first spoke in November of 2017. Your first book had just come out. The name of your first book was Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other. And I have to tell you, what a heartwarming story. And now You've got a second book out. Let's tell the listeners what the title is.
Yeah, of course. My next book is called Second Chances, A Marine, His Dog, and Finding Redemption. I would encourage people to read Craig and Fred, of course, but it is certainly not required reading to pick up Second Chances and jump right into to where Fred and I are in this next chapter.
All right, let's break it down where you are in this next chapter. Why the title, Second Chances, A Marine, His Dog, and Finding Redemption?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think it struck me very early on in the writing process, and when I was first kind of coming up with the concept for this book, that, you know, just reviewing my life and comparing it to some men that are incarcerated up here in our home state of Maine, in Maine State Prison, you know, I realized very quickly that the trajectory of my life was because of a lot of second chances that I had received through, you know, just dumb luck in some circumstances, you know, and that was really the only thing that separated me from a similar situation to the men that I've grown close with up in Maine State Prison.
Tell us all about the service dog training program at the Maine State Prison. How does it work? Where do the dogs come from? Where do they go after they graduate?
Yes, so the it's a really incredible nonprofit called America's Vet Dogs, and they just raise and breed some of the most high caliber service dogs that are available for veterans and also people with disabilities, people who are blind or deaf or have different needs. They really have a real high standard for their dogs, and so it's pretty incredible that they entrust the first, you know, year plus of those dogs training to men behind bars. And they have dog programs in prisons all up and down the East Coast. And one of them happens to be in Maine. And so for the first, you know, 15 months or so of the dog's life, they go into the prison as little, you know, wobbly puppies. And within a couple of weeks they're doing things that I would need a pile of filet mignon to get Fred to do. And it's a really incredible thing to watch. And then when the dog is completely trained, it gets paired with a veteran with needs for a service dog. And those needs can vary from post-traumatic stress to some other, you know, more specific physical challenges. And it's a really incredible thing to watch that process. And I'm excited for the reader to kind of come along on that ride.
What a great program. You know, as I said when we started the interview, Second Chances is your second book. It's your second book built around the bonds between humans and dogs. First part of the question, why is that relationship so special? And what has your relationship been with Fred over these years?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think first, yeah, the relationship is so special for a lot of reasons. I think, you know, that we all become close to our dogs and our animals for our own reasons, and the bond means its own things to each person, you know, individually, depending on the dog or the, you know, the circumstances of the relationship. For me, with Fred, it's been, you know, it's been everything from just having that, you know, classic happy dog ready for anything when you come home from a long day at work, you know, that's just excited to see you and that, you know, that we all, you know, can, I think everybody can appreciate about a dog, to the on a deeper level, a more specific level for me and Fred is the bond of hardship and the bond of trauma and combat in his original home of Sang in Afghanistan, you know, and that purpose that comes between, you know, two beings that go through similar things, and so that bond has just kind of grown stronger and stronger over the years. And the third thing is really our story. Telling the story of Fred became my purpose when I came home from Afghanistan, and it's really grown just from telling it in dog parks and street corners to what I'm doing now.
Yeah, to bring our readers or our listeners up to speed, you know, Craig is an 8-year Marine Corps veteran, and he rescued Fred from Afghanistan. How old is Fred now?
He's, you know, I can never get a straight answer out of him. he talks in riddles, but now he's probably 11. I would say maybe a little bit older, but it's hard to, I mean, sometimes he feels like he's 11 months. You know, he's still got a lot of energy, and if he doesn't get his exercise every day, he lets me know. You know, at night, you know, he gets what he needs.
I hear you. We're talking to Craig Grossi. Craig is an author. Again, he's an 8-year Marine Corps vet. He's written another book. It's called Second Chances, A Marine, His Dog, and Finding Redemption. I want to talk about the past year and the COVID pandemic, Craig. You know, it's affected the entire world. How did the pandemic affect your ability to volunteer and visit with the guys you talk about in this book at the Maine State Prison?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was detrimental to my visits, and more substantially to the mental health of the men, who really, we really got in a great rhythm, and the whole group really became very close, and we all kind of leaned really heavily on those meetings every week and seeing each other and talking. And and at the time, you know, we would be together for hours every week, and the time just would fly. And then, like, you know, so many people are, you know, around the world, COVID just brought everything to a halt. And so, you know, my first concern was, you know, for the men, both for the, you know, because COVID wreaked havoc in prisons all over the world. And I was really worried that it would make its way into Maine State Prison, and then also just, like, you know, for the men being locked down and being confined and not having access to the programs and the things that you know help them during their time behind bars, you know, really, really worried me. But eventually we got we got set up with everybody, we had to transition into the world of Zoom, and I'm proud to say, you know, that we've made that transition. And you know, it's not the same, but I've been keeping up with the guys, and I've even started to see more new members of our writing group every week on our weekly Zooms. And so it's been a challenge, but you know, we're counting our blessings like so many.
Craig, when people read Second Chances, your second book, what do you want them to take away from their reading?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think. I always like for people to kind of come in with an open mind and to take whatever they need away from my writing. But it's my hope that people, if nothing else, come away with maybe a different perspective on the people, the millions of Americans who have served or are serving time in our jails and prisons. I think for too long we've really just kind of cast them aside and not wanted to really think about the people we've locked up. And I think it's a disservice not only to them, but to the country as a whole. And so it's my hope that if nothing else, people can really, we can change the conversation and change the perspective on people who have served time behind bars.
This book is on sale now. Where can we find it?
Just about anywhere. You can get it on all your favorite online retailers, and you know, I always encourage people to go find a local bookstore and get your copies there. That we love Browse About Books in Rehoboth, and there's so many great local bookstores that really need the support. So, you know, I always encourage people to do that if you have the means.
Thanks to author and former Marine Craig Grossi and R. Kelly Steele for being with us on this week's Arts Playlist. And stay tuned, Enlighten Me looks at advances made to a tool to help commercial fishers avoid the endangered Atlantic sturgeon, which they often catch accidentally. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A few years ago, we brought you a story about a tool that helps fishers avoid accidentally catching the endangered Atlantic sturgeon. This week, we have an update on the locally developed technology. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with University of Delaware postdoctoral researcher Matthew Breese and UD College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment professor Matthew Oliver about how the tool is used and how it's evolved since it was first released.
Your team developed a forecasting tool for fishers to use when trying to avoid Atlantic sturgeon. Can you just first, Matt Breese, give us a little bit of background? What is this fish and why would fishers need to avoid it?
Yeah, so Atlantic sturgeon are a really large kind of mysterious fish, especially here in Delaware. They're where caviar comes from. So originally they were fished out in the late 1800s, early 1900s for this caviar fishery in the Delaware River. And the Delaware River was the largest fishery for Atlantic sturgeon on the whole East Coast before that overfishing event, and then subsequent poor water quality kept them from recovering, the population recovering. So we do have a few around Delaware and in the Delaware Bay and Delaware River seasonally. And a lot of people don't know about that, so they're pretty cool.
When you say a few, is this like a handful?
So yeah, there's the current population estimates for the actual Delaware River population are pretty poor. We're thinking less than 300 spawning adults every year. Now that changes as you move from the river out into the mouth of the Delaware Bay and along the coast, because we have a lot of Atlantic sturgeon from populations up and down the East Coast that were spawned in other rivers come and hang out in the mouth of the Delaware Bay. So we could have thousands of individuals that occur in the Delaware Bay every summer that nest aren't necessarily from the Delaware River.
And when commercial fishers are out and there's a risk of disturbing sturgeon, is this like bycatch or is this like just the presence of a fishing boat in the area would disturb the sturgeon?
Yeah, the main concern is bycatch and harm to them in gillnet fisheries, especially in the Delaware Bay.
Okay, so Matt Breese, how does this forecasting tool work for a fisher?
Okay, so if you're a fisherman, you would get a text message or an email to your phone. And in that phone, we do it's almost like a tweet, right? We limited the number of characters to as few as possible so that it can come out in a clear, concise message. And in that, it'll tell the fisherman what section of the bay and what the depth range is, where sturgeon are either at medium level of risk occurrence or a high level of risk occurrence. So if it's low level, they won't even get a text at all. They don't have to worry about it. But if they have a medium threat or a high threat, they'll get a message, and they'll get a message where that threat is, with also a map for when that showing where those areas are, you know, in a visual form, and then also a link to our forecasting tool where they can dig into some more information if they need to.
And Matt Oliver, what kind of data is this system built on? Like, how do you guys know where the sturgeon might be?
So the sturgeon forecast tool is dependent on two main data sources. One is historic acoustic telemetry observations of Atlantic sturgeon that we've been recording with our partners at Delaware State University for many years. We've partnered with them on that research. And that is a series of essentially buoys that are out in the water and then a sturgeon that have been telemetered with an acoustic tag. So when a fish swims by the buoy, you know exactly where it is. So we had 5 or 6 years of that information, and we combined that with satellite observations from a satellite receiving station at the University of Delaware, where we track multiple satellites from NASA and from NOAA. And that satellite data comes in every day, and we take that and we understand the relationship between that satellite information, both the temperature of the bay and also how cloudy and how turbid the bay is, and we relate that to our understanding of where the fish are. And based on that, we can make a very accurate prediction of where these fish are going to be.
So a few years ago, we covered the first iteration of the Text Alert tool. Matt Breese, what has changed about the tool since then?
So we've incorporated a good bit of new data into the forecasting tool. We added, the original forecasting tool was based solely on NASA satellites. We added NOAA satellites into the tool as well to get a more clear, better picture, and also to increase the longevity of the tool going forward. So the NASA satellites have been out for a couple decades now, and they're kind of at the end of life, but the NOAA satellites are new. So we want to make that transition into the new satellites so this tool can be out long-term. We've also took some suggestions from the fishermen of how they would like to receive the text messages and the information, so that we can give them the data on a more timely manner without actually over spamming them with our messages to them.
And how widely do you think this tool is being used?
It's always a little bit hard to know how often sort of a free service like this is being used. You know, you can track hits or you can do those kinds of things. But there's not that many fishers on the bay that actually fish the bay that much. And so we know, just talking with our partners, that there was a fair number of fishers using it for a while. We do know that when the pandemic hit, the location of sturgeon in the bay was not their major concern anymore. There was a lot of folks really hit with severe economic hardships. And so we turned the text messaging off. The model was still running if people wanted to use it. We haven't seen a pickup yet after the pandemic. We think that will increase in the future. But we also are looking to new users of the tool. We know that we're going to have quite a bit of wind power development out here in the coastal ocean, and they also have to account for the location of the Atlantic sturgeon. And so we've been in conversations with industry groups about this tool in different places. And so we think that ecosystem forecasting like this, specifically in this area, we're going to get a lot more traction with folks as construction starts and things like that. So I think overall, our user base is going to go up.
And is this a model that could be used for other marine species that are endangered?
Absolutely. And I think this project overall had two really big things going for it. Number one is that we had a lot of satellite data in this region. And the second thing is that because the Atlantic sturgeon was endangered, there are quite a few historical studies that had been funded in the region. So we knew quite a bit about the species, about where they might be, and how to relate those observations of where the fish are to the environment. So there are other forecasting tools that are out there for species that you have lots of information for, like sea turtles, things like that. But there are also a lot of species what we don't have a lot of information for. And so I would say the limiting factor here is not necessarily the availability of satellite data, because that seems to be going fairly strong, but it's going to be getting the information that we want for other species of concern or other commercial species that we might be interested in. But certainly the work that we've done here, I think, is definitely a model for how we can deal with species, especially highly migratory species like the Atlantic sturgeon. So other ones, I mean, almost all the species that we have here in Delaware are highly migratory because the temperature range changes so much. So we think it's a really nice model for moving forward.
Matthew Breese and Matthew Oliver of UD's College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
And thanks to our Sophia Schmidt for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. And thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengate, and Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.